This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
We will talk jobs today because you got to be consistent, right? Also, though, supersonic airplanes, and we will take you out for a pasta dinner. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the third day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. At the risk of belaboring a point, although I suppose it is too late in the week to back down now, you want substantive economic news this week? It's jobs. Today we got weekly first-time claims for jobless benefits. 385,000 is the number. Yes, still high, but look, honestly, within range of what was normal in the before times. The May monthly unemployment report comes out tomorrow morning, and while all eyes are going to be on the headline number, which will be, yes, important, that ain't the only piece of data that matters in that report. One of the things that we are going to be looking at is long-term unemployment, the percentage of people who are out of work who've been looking for a job for at least 6 months. In the last monthly report, it was 43%, that number, nearly as high as it was in the Great Recession. We have talked before on this program about the harm that's been done to people and the economy by long-term unemployment. So Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman starts us off today with what might help the long-term unemployed get back to work.
With a freshly minted master's degree in public policy, 26-year-old McKenna Brock has been job hunting for more than a year.
Some days, you know, I sit down and go through 20, 30 applications. And I mean, I'm happy to go wherever there's work, but the problem is that there isn't much work. Or that I'm not finding it.
She's landed some interviews, but no offers. She keeps hearing that someone with more experience got the job.
You know, when you get constant rejection over and over and over again, it does start to feel a little bit deflating. You start to doubt yourself. Something I'm doing isn't working right.
She knows a lot of people are going through the same thing.
I mean, like my mom, she's got years of marketing and she can't find a job.
That's Tiffany Brock, who got laid off from her job managing national beverage sales for a company in Tucson, Arizona, back in June 2020.
I've got a great resume, I've got great experience, and I started applying. Unfortunately, so did everybody else.
Some jobs had thousands of applicants. She found some of the process humiliating.
They didn't even start interviews until after you wrote essays and why you wanted to work for the company. They wanted videos demonstrating your best career moment.
The first challenge folks like the Brocks face, says UMass Amherst sociologist Ofer Sharon, the stigma of long-term unemployment. Employers are less likely to hire them. And, says Sharon,
there's a tendency for job seekers to internalize the stigma, have fears that, yeah, maybe something is wrong with me.
Leading in turn, says Carnegie Mellon psychologist Denise Rousseau, to
a loss of confidence, a high level of anxiety with looking for employment, interviewing, re-entering the workforce, and that tends to be a self-perpetuating cycle.
First order of business in helping the long-term unemployed, says Sharon, is to connect them with support and solidarity groups and counseling.
Recognizing not only does it take a long time to get a job, people may be feeling shame, addressing that head on, and then start to talk about strategy and networking and resumes.
Denise Rousseau says as employers staff up again, they would do themselves a favor to tap current employees to recommend their unemployed friends for jobs.
People who have friends in an organization where they're being hired are more likely to be successful and to be retained in that organization.
Public policy has a role to play, too. Ofer Sharon argues that government should bar employers from discriminating against the long-term unemployed. Peter Capelli, director of the Center for Human Resources at the Wharton School, says government-directed retraining programs have a poor track record. Instead, he suggests going hyper-local, linking schools with employers.
You could say, for example, let's figure out what these, you know, small group of employers in this town really needs and what they really think they're going to be doing in the next year or two.
For her part, Tiffany Brock is more worried about her daughter's long-term unemployment and career prospects than her own. She says she doesn't feel much stigma being out of work this long because the pandemic took her job.
It feels like you have permission to be unemployed. Obviously, being let go wasn't based on my performance or ability to help the bottom line. It truly was a condition of nature, right?
Ideally, employers will feel the same way. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
8:30 tomorrow morning, Washington time, for that May unemployment report, by the way. On Wall Street today, a little soft ahead of Jobs Day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Imagine the year 2029. You take maybe a hover car or something from Manhattan out to JFK Airport. There, you get on a supersonic jet that can get you to London in something like 3.5 hours. Fantasy? Well, perhaps, but United Airlines is betting on it. The company announced today it has agreed to buy 15 of those faster-than-the-speed-of-sound jets from the aerospace startup Boom Supersonic. To be clear, those jets do not yet exist. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on the Future of Aviation beat today.
The jet United has agreed to buy is called the Overture, and the obvious comparison is with the Concorde, which, even with $20,000 tickets, was a business failure and stopped flying in 2003. Richard Aboulafia is aviation analyst with Thiel Group.
The most important lesson of Concorde is that you need government to pay the entire upfront expense. And even with all of that, it still couldn't make money. That's as instructive as it gets about the realities of supersonic economics.
So the idea that this is supersonic flight making a comeback?
This is theater, nothing more.
One firm did early feasibility studies with Boom Supersonic. That's Boyd Group International. Michael Boyd is president. He says a lot has changed since the Concorde.
Let me go down the list. Ozzie and Harriet is off of TV. We don't buy hula hoops anymore. We don't have black and white TVs anymore. The Concorde rolled out of the hangar 54 years ago.
The Overture, by contrast, would be based on modern technology and be carbon neutral. Blake Scholl is CEO of Boom Supersonic.
We have carbon fiber composites. We have software-optimized aerodynamics. We have new engines that are more efficient and quieter.
He says the Overture's operating costs will be 75% lower than the Concorde's. United's order is the first true civilian order for supersonic planes since the 1970s, says Scholl. And the airline put down what he called a meaningful deposit. Mike Leskinen is VP of Corporate Development at United.
You can make the economics work with the business class fares that you see today. And certainly the goal is to bring it to a broad swath of our customers over time.
Boom rolled out a prototype last year called the XB-1, which CEO Scholl says will be in the skies by early next year. He says the Overture itself could be in test flights by 2026. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Don't know if you saw that video clip that made the rounds last week. Senator Elizabeth Warren taking J.P. Morgan's CEO Jamie Dimon to task over the $1.5 billion his bank made in overdraft fees last year. Warren asked if Dimon would give those fees back. Dimon said no. But the online bank Ally said today, you know what? We suspended overdraft fees during the pandemic, and now we are going to do away with them entirely. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has that story.
Banks make a lot of money off of overdraft fees. Last year, $12 billion. But a lot of them temporarily stopped charging those fees during the pandemic. When Ally did,
we learned a lot from that experience.
Diane Moray is president of consumer and commercial banking at Ally.
Less than 1% of Ally's deposit customers experience this fee. But for that population, it's impactful.
And Moray says,
we looked at this fee and saw that it really disproportionately impacted Black and Latino households.
That is true in general, not just at Ally. And Rebecca Borne at the Center for Responsible Lending says people who pay overdraft fees most often tend to have low incomes and balances of $350 on average.
So we're talking about individuals who are struggling month in and month out to keep their account balances positive.
While banks make billions on these fees, Maya Rodriguez-Valladares at MRV Associates says it's a drop in the bucket for most of them.
The globally systemically important banks also have economies of scale that very much would allow them to reduce, at least, if not fully eliminate, the overdraft fees, and it would barely affect their quarter-to-quarter earnings.
At Ally, overdraft fees made up less than 1% of revenue. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Streaming is everything right now. We all know that. We're all doing it, and companies are spending billions of dollars on it. Most recent case in point, Amazon buying MGM Studios. The biggest name in streaming, though, is said to be chasing something else. The Information is reporting that Netflix is looking to get into gaming. Why? And what might that look like? Marketplace's Kristen Schwab is on it.
Netflix has already been experimenting with interactive content. Last year, it released a movie-length episode of its series, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. It's a choose-your-own-adventure story.
There is so much to be done before our wedding, like practicing for our honeymoon.
Oh, boy. I do like kissing you.
And I you.
But planning is also fun.
Okay, so this isn't exactly a video game, but you can see where this could go. Maybe a Black Mirror adventure game or a Queen's Gambit-themed chess game. There's a lot of intellectual property to mine. Tim Hanlon is with the Verter Group.
The notion is that consumers will find such content to be more engaging and be part of the action, so to speak.
The other thing Netflix is pretty good at? Acquiring licensing for other content. Hanlon says the company could offer a rotating mix of video games from other creators. It could even have its own console. Whatever Netflix does, there's a big knowledge gap to work out. Mukul Krishna is with Frost & Sullivan.
Because if you're saying that, hey, I want to develop a gaming platform, that is an entire new set of expertise that Netflix will have to acquire.
Still, he says now is the time to acquire them. Better access to broadband and 5G is making cloud gaming easier. The global gaming industry is booming with a little help from the pandemic. It's worth more than $300 billion, according to Accenture. And with all the streaming competition, Netflix needs to maintain its subscriber growth. In an email, Netflix said, "Members enjoy engaging more directly with stories they love. We're excited to do more with interactive entertainment." I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Early on a Friday morning, you need your business and economic news. Might I suggest the Marketplace Morning Report? Check it out. Coming up.
It was my now 9-year-old's birthday party today.
Well, happy birthday, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's down 23 points today, less than a tenth percent, 34,577. The NASDAQ down 141 points, about 1%, 13,614. S&P 500 down 15, about 3 tenths percent, 41.92. $100,000. Today, the Justice for Greenwood Foundation announced they will give that amount to each of the three survivors of the Tulsa Race Massacre, which happened, as you know, 100 years ago this week. We heard from Sam Fields that Ally Bank is getting rid of overdraft fees. Ally Financial down 0.9% today. In advance of tomorrow's job numbers, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce released its America Works report this week. The report says the insurance industry is facing, and this is the quote, a retirement cliff. 50% of insurance professionals are set to retire over the next 15 years, leaving about 400,000 jobs available. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Institute for Supply Management was out with its monthly update on the health of American manufacturing earlier this week. Generally doing all right, but supply chains and logistics are challenging. Not breaking news exactly, but it did remind us that we've been meaning to get Sam Desai back on the phone. He is the vice president at RM Metals in South Plainfield, New Jersey. They make parts for cars and for small appliances as well. First couple of times we had Sam on, it was about the Trump administration's steel and aluminum tariffs and how he was dealing with them. So with those tariffs still happening, it's important to point out, and with the pandemic waning, I asked him how business is going.
Business has picked up significantly. At this point last year, we had almost 50-60% reduction in sales. Today, we're up more than 120% increase since that time. So it's significantly a lot better today than it was last year.
You are, though, just to get tariffs and trade out of the way here, you are still dealing with steel tariffs, right?
I am dealing with steel tariffs on a daily basis. And that Section 232 is on my mind on a daily, maybe many times a day. We just discuss it and figure out what's going on.
Is it costing you money?
It's costing a lot of money. We have paid probably a lot of money over the last couple of years.
So let's talk for a second about where we go from here, right? About pent-up demand, about your customers and what they want out of you. We've been through, as you just said, a tough year and a half. What do you anticipate the next, 6 to 8 months is like for you?
Well, the country opening up, it has really pumped up the demand. And I think we're not there yet. I think the market's going to open up more and then maybe level off in Q1 of next year.
Of next year. Wow.
Yeah, we're very optimistic for the rest of the year at this point, and so are many of the industries we deal in.
All right, so let's roll all this into a couple of quick questions here on the way out. First of all, you're dealing with tariffs. You're dealing with supply chain issues. You've got a lot of demand coming. Do you have pricing power now if you needed to raise prices, if you wanted to raise prices? Could you do that?
Yes. I believe that people are starting to except the higher prices because of the pent-up demand and supply is a little bit short. But it's very tough to get people to accept it because, they have to forward on to someone else in the future.
Right. Do you ever back down if a customer objects too much?
We try to negotiate and work out the customer because they've been there for us. So
yeah, fair enough. Okay, so the follow-on question to prices is, how worried are you about once sort of we get through the summer and the pent-up demand, do you expect inflation to be a factor in this economy, or are you not so much worried about that? Put on your Jay Powell hat for me here for a minute.
Oh, man. I believe that there will be some kind of inflation. If you look around, lumber costs has gone up. Metals have gone up in price. Yeah, we do expect a little bit of inflation to kick in.
Do you expect it to last, though? I mean, like 6 months from now, are we still having the inflation conversation?
I think in 6 months from now, things will kind of flatten out.
Yeah.
But the price increases that have gone through have been the last 6 months, and I don't think that hit the consumer fully yet.
Last thing, and then I'll honestly get out of your hair. How long do you figure it's going to be, Mr. Desai, until things are some version of normal for you?
Well, hopefully if the pandemic clears up, then I think the country will be back to normal by mid-next year.
Here's hoping. Sam Desai, he's vice president at RM Metals. We got him in South Plainfield, New Jersey. Mr. Desai, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Back late last year, Mariel Segarra took us out to a pasta restaurant in Brooklyn. Pasta Louise, it's called, which had just opened in July, that is last July, in the teeth of a pandemic, well before there was an approved vaccine and before anybody had any idea of how bad things might get in a coronavirus winter. Well, Pasta Luis made it. Turns out there are a lot of people who wanted to get out of their houses, even if that meant huddling under a heater in 30-degree weather to eat pasta in New York City. And now, business is booming, but spring has brought a whole new set of challenges. Here's Marielle.
It's a Wednesday, around 5 p.m. The dinner rush hasn't even started yet, and Allison Arevalo is already exhausted.
Last night, the general manager and I were here till about 11 o'clock at night washing dishes for the entire dinner service because our dishwasher didn't show up and we can't get anyone else to cover. It's just been impossible to find staff.
The weather's been beautiful. Also, people are vaccinated and they're hungry. Arevalo has a staff of about 30. The exact number kind of depends on the day. And about 5 open positions. On Thursday, it looks like her staffing problems are getting worse.
So I woke up this morning to a bunch of time off requests from staff that wondering how we're going to be able to approve because we just don't have enough people.
They have plenty of customers, and a lot of them feel connected to the restaurant. This morning, she got word that one donated $2,500 to the restaurant's scholarship fund. Arevalo started it in honor of her sister, who died from cancer.
This year, we have $10,000 to give out to a Brooklyn student who lost a parent to cancer. So that was good. That was some good news in all the craziness.
Around 3:30 in the afternoon, Arevalo checks in from the restaurant, where all the seating is outdoors. She'll be hosting the dinner service tonight. Her assistant general manager will bus tables, and they have someone new coming in to wash dishes.
Hopefully he'll make it through the night. Dishwashing at our restaurant is really, really hard. It's a super small space. It gets really hot. So hopefully he'll wanna stick it out.
She's a little nervous about tonight. She's had customers flip out recently because the food is taking too long or they don't want to sit at that table near the mailbox or they don't want to wear masks indoors to use the bathroom and the restaurant requires them.
Yeah, it's just hard when we're not fully staffed, when, you know, customers don't realize when they have to maybe wait a little bit longer or when we run out of water cups or wine glasses because, you know, we're just training a new dishwasher. So hopefully it'll be a smooth service tonight.
A few hours later, things are not going smoothly.
It's 6 o'clock on Thursday night, and our dinner shift is on its way. Our dishwasher that we were training did not work out. He was listening to music on headphones and was not wanting to take any direction.
So they dismissed him, paid him for half a shift. Now they have to start the search all over again. Arevalo is also trying to hire line cooks, an assistant, and a host.
But you put these ads up and just no one answers. You get like one or two responses. Most of the time, the people don't even live in this country. We get responses from people who live in like Turkey or Italy.
One possible reason? Some people left the restaurant industry and New York City during the pandemic. Some restaurants have raised starting wages to attract staff. Pasta Luis hasn't. Arevalo's not sure she can afford to, but says she pays more than the city's minimum wage and gives raises and bonuses often. Given how tight the space is and how much business she has, Arevalo has been looking for a second location, but now she doesn't know if she'll be able to staff it. On Friday night, she checks in. They've got a band playing.
Beautiful night in Brooklyn, sunny, warm.
She's been mulling something over. Pasta Luis is closed on Mondays. Maybe she should close on Tuesdays, too.
You know, normally restaurants close because they don't have enough business. We might close a day because we have too much business. Crazy problem to have.
The next morning, Arevalo gets to the restaurant, and there's a clogged pipe in the basement.
And there was just dirty water everywhere. It's just nuts. It's just nuts all the time. And then I was hosting for lunch, and then I had to go run. It was my now nine-year-old's birthday party today, so I had to run home and set up for the birthday party. It's just a lot. It's a lot. I'm so tired. I'm getting dizzy.
Which is why she makes the call. They will close on Tuesdays.
We have to. We don't really have a choice. I can't do this to myself. I can't do it to my staff anymore.
Tuesdays are not a slow day. She will be missing out on business. But they've reached their limit. Just after 9 p.m., Arevalo gets on her bike and heads home to see her son before he falls asleep. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
final note on the way out today, an update to an item we report on from time to time. Who exactly is running the biggest companies in this economy? The Fortune 500 is the sample size. 2021 is the time frame, and that gets us to this. On this year's list, there are two black women running Fortune 500 companies. That is a first, if embarrassingly low. 41 women in all running Fortune 500 companies. If you want to do the math, that is just 8.1% of the leadership of the biggest companies in this economy being women. All right, we got to go, but here's your moment of economic context. We are going to talk to a used car dealer here in the next couple of days about what he is seeing on his lot. But here is a new car tidbit I saw on Bloomberg today. New cars are scarce, as you know, chip shortage and all. In normal supply chain times, JP Morgan analysts say dealers usually have about 60 days worth of inventory sitting on their lots. Now, not 60, but 23 days supply. How about that? Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Beth Perlman, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.